Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The View from Rat Lake by John Gearock, narrated by David Colacci. I can report that pleasure wears well. Andy Rooney. In my limited way of seeing things, I feel this will go on forever. Russell Chatham. If the trout are lost, smash the state. Thomas McGuane. Introduction. In the world of fishing, there are magic phrases that are guaranteed to summon the demon. Among them are remote trout lake, fish up to 13 pounds, the place the guides fish on their days off, and my travel agent. There's power in words like that. Place names also help. The purely descriptive ones, like Shiprock Lake and Lone Pine, are okay, but add poetry or even irony and the effect is heightened. Take Rat Lake, for example. A good fisherman could call you up on the phone, rattle off an incantation like that, and make you wrench your elbow going for your checkbook too quickly. I didn't hurt my elbow, but I did manage to pull a muscle in my back a few days before I was supposed to leave for Rat Lake. And it was one of those scheduled trips, too. I was to meet a friend at his office. Yes, I do have some friends with offices. We would drive to the airport, meet a third guy, fly to Bozeman, Montana to meet a fourth guy, and so on. It was not one that could have been casually put off for a week while your back healed up. You go or you cancel, period. Now, I'm not generally a wuss about these things, but the back was actually quite sore, and I had my doubts about being able to get into a pair of waders and a belly boat without help. I called my kindly old white-haired doc and said, "What the hell should I do?" expecting him to prescribe a vial of pastel-colored miracle pills that would fix it overnight. "Well," Doc said, "go fishing, and if you catch one that hurts you to lift, break him off. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have sick people to take care of." So I went fishing. Doctor's orders. We stayed at a guest ranch in a sweet little log cabin with a stone fireplace and a big stack of dry wood. And it was a good thing, too, because the famous Big Sky was low and dark and drizzling a cold, steady rain that had an ominously permanent feel to it. When you're far from home, at some expense, it's not feasible to wait this kind of thing out in a bar, because you either don't have enough time or in too much of a hurry. The former just happens to you, while the latter you do to yourself, but they amount to the same thing. You bundle up and fish. That's what you came for. At least there's a warm, dry place to come dragging back to. From what I'd been told about it, Rat Lake fell into the category that's often described by fishermen as a son of a bitch. It's not all that difficult to get to, if you don't mind slogging uphill on a wet, slimy clay trail with a fully loaded float tube strapped to your back, and it's small enough and shallow enough to fish easily with a fly rod. The problem with Rat Lake, and the other sons of bitches like it, is that you can't catch the fish. Or, more properly, you can only catch a very few of them, and those only by putting in first hours and then days of trying this and that, here and there, always waiting for the caddis hatch, spinner fall, or whatever else it takes for the huge trout of local legend to show themselves. Lakes like this are considered worth the trouble, especially by those few, usually locals, who have seen and perhaps even caught some of the fish. As it turns out, some guides do fish Rat Lake on their days off. It's the kind of fishing you have to be in the mood for, and I was in the mood. It was spring, and I'd been a good boy for most of the winter, working hard on several things, including this book. I figured I owed myself some serious big trout fishing from cushy accommodations because, well, that's what writers do, isn't it? They finish the book and then go off to Paris to drink and carouse, or to Montana to fish and drink, to relax, let the well fill up, and prove to themselves once again that they don't really give a damn about much of anything. At least that's what my study of literature seems to indicate. Of course, this was in country where grizzly bears are known to live, and we'd spent some time in a bar the evening before trying to scare the one member of the party who had never been to Montana before and had some misgivings in this area. We told him the way to tell a black bear from a grizzly is that the black will follow you up a tree, while the grizz will just shake you out. He sipped his jumper cable, a local drink that warms you up after a cold day of fishing, but also causes nightmares, and said he was more scared of rattlesnakes than bears. I said, sure, but if a rattler gets you, at least they'll find more of you than your shoes. You probably know that the .44 Magnum is the handgun of choice among those who worry about grizzly bears. But did you know that the .357 Mag, no slouch in the deadly weapon department, is known in some circles as a bear tickler? Yes, sir, your best chance with the .357 is to shoot the bear with it and then slip away while he's busy laughing. This is all pretty cruel, I suppose, but it's one of those manly things we men do to each other for no reason than that it was once done to us. I won't glorify it by calling it a rite of passage. The following morning we climbed to Rat Lake. We found it to be just above the altitude where, on the second to the last day in May, the rain changes to snow. The lake was in a small bowl with steep-sided, thickly forested hills rising around it. The air and the water were still, and the slopes of the hills wandered in and out of the low clouds. The water was trout cool, but the air was cooler, and steam rose from the lake. You couldn't ask for a prettier view, but you could sure ask for better weather to be out in. We managed roughly 4 hours on the water, enough time to determine that the fishing was somewhere between very slow and dead. One small trout had been landed, and another had been hooked briefly. The best guess was that those monster trout, inscrutable enough under normal conditions, were moping under the bottomed-out barometer. It's a little-known fact that the barometer was actually invented by a fisherman. Its original purpose was not to measure atmospheric pressure, but to provide scientific-sounding excuses for not catching fish. I was the first one off the water, in spite of the fact that I hate to be the one to crap out while everyone else is still at it, even on a day when you have to stop to shake the snow off of your fly rod every few minutes. On the other hand, cold is cold, and when you're not catching fish, there isn't much else to think about. I hadn't given up on the idea of sticking it out. A lake like this can take more patience than skill to crack, but I wanted to stick it out next to a little campfire, so I walked into the woods looking for something resembling dry wood. I walked out of sight of the lake into a thick stand of spruce, but the old trick of finding dry, dead branches low down on the trunks was clearly not going to work. The snow fell on the top of the forest and then percolated down to fall as rain under what would normally be the cover of trees. The pattering of water on the pine needles was the only sound. I was wet, cold, miserable, and fishless, but oddly enough, I now recall it all as being very beautiful. Right about then, I was struck with a serious case of bearanoia. If you've never had bearanoia, it's difficult to describe. Often you don't see, hear, or smell anything even mildly suspicious, but are nonetheless struck by the unreasoning certainty that you were about to be killed and eaten by a 1,500-pound, drooling, carnivorous animal. A half pint of adrenaline enters your cerebral cortex, and that's hard to describe, too. You want to run, but something also tells you you're not supposed to run. Then you realize you can't run because your legs don't work, and it's pretty much over. There you are in this lovely, misty, dripping, primeval-looking coniferous forest, one of the prettiest places you can remember seeing, trying not to mess your pants. In a few more seconds it's gone, and you are left with only a vague, uneasy feeling that you don't belong there, that you are, in fact, trespassing. With the gods as my witness, I will never tell another bear story in a bar again, nor will I ever drink another jumper cable. There may have been some dry wood in there somewhere, but I returned to the lake with a hastily gathered armload of rubbery, dripping twigs that would not start, even with the help of the sports page from the local newspaper. When the boys saw what I was up to, they all paddled in to get warm and then stood around helplessly as the last pitiful whiffs of smoke vanished into the falling snow. Someone said that although this might be considered a nice day in Oregon, around here we get the hell out before we freeze to death. And that's what we did. The next morning we lingered over breakfast at the Corral Café, as the snow, which had moved downhill overnight, began to stick in the parking lot. It was observed that it would be even colder at the lake today, and snowing harder, that maybe the dirt road to the trailhead was no longer passable, that the barometer was still low, and so on. We finally agreed that Rat Lake, with its big rainbow, cutthroat hybrids, might as well be on another planet, and that the best thing to do was pack up and go to Idaho, where we'd been told it wasn't snowing nearly as hard. The café was warm and cozy and smelled of good food. The log walls were covered with the obligatory skins, antlers, and stuffed heads. You can see more wildlife in some of these joints than you would in a week in the backcountry. Over the bar was a sign saying, "Caution! The Surgeon General has determined that bar tabs cause amnesia." Ah, Montana, with its big rivers, big trout, log taverns, lonely cowboys, boyish fishing guides, pickup trucks, cats sleeping on pool tables, grizzly bears, straightforward sense of humor, and late snowstorms, where they watch the stream flows more closely than the stock market. As a place to drink coffee and figure out what to do next, it's better than most. As we walked out to the truck with Idaho on our minds, someone asked me, "Well, what are you going to write about Rat Lake?" I said I didn't know, but that I'd think of something, and it occurred to me that writing and fishing are alike in at least three ways. Both demand a degree of persistence, both can turn out differently than you'd planned, and both are worth doing for their own sakes, even if you don't get what you're after. That is, either fish or money. It also occurred to me that my back didn't hurt anymore, or if it did, it wasn't enough to worry about. Just the normal stiffness from uphill walking and belly boating in cold water. I was cured. There must be a moral there somewhere. Big Sky, Montana, 1987. The Big Empty River. Last summer, the notorious Charles K. Coke Winter bought it on the Henry's Fork in southern Idaho, by which I mean he took a fall and broke his leg. "A word of advice," he told me recently. "If you're ever walking along the banks of the Henry's Fork and a pair of sandhill cranes fly over, stop walking first, then look." If Coke was going to break something while fishing, and anyone who knows him would have told you it was just waiting to happen, it's like him to do it on one of the most famous trout streams in the world. He has a way of doing things like that, of engineering even his accidents so that in the retelling they can't help but sound heroic. He somehow managed to achieve a spiral fracture, the classic downhill skiing injury, and so naturally someone down at the health club asked him, in that snide way people have when you're hurt, "How's the skiing?" "I don't go in for sissy sports," Coke answered. "I'm a trout fisherman." That kind of style is something you have to be born with. I've never broken anything on the Henry's Fork, not even a fly rod, but I've fished it every year since the first time I laid eyes on it. That puts me in the company of thousands of other fly fishers from all over the country and even in the rest of the world. The people whose cars and trucks, during the green dray catch at least, make that little patch of gravel in front of Mike Lawson's fly shop look like the parking lot at the United Nations building. I first fished the river because it had become unavoidable. Everyone talked about it, quoted magazine articles about it, showed pictures of it, and even drove up there to fish in it now and then. More to the point, they all used it as a kind of measure against which all other trout streams were judged. A great rainbow trout was like a Henry's fork fish. A heavy mayfly hatch was like you'd see on the Henry's fork. A wide, slow section of any river was just like the fork above Osborne Bridge. I got the feeling they must have a 100-yard stretch of it on display at the Bureau of Standards as an example of the trout stream, right next to the foot, the pound, and so on. I finally had to go fish the thing just so I could hold up my end of the conversation. That first trip was something of a turning point. It wasn't my first famous river, but it was my first truly mythological one. It was also the first time I fished with Coke and began to get an inkling of how famous he was. Everyone knew him, and everyone who took the time to talk had a story, each one less believable than the last. Enormous trout, convoluted ethics, feats of strength and daring, elaborate practical jokes, and other things, too. Coke winter stories could fill a book, and I hope they do someday. Of course, Coke will have to write it himself. No one else would dare to say half of it in print. Some years later, while I was working in a fly shop in Boulder, Colorado, Coke came in doing his jerk act, asking about our live bait selection, referring to the fly rods as crawler poles and so on. It was clear to the other customers that we knew each other, so when he left, someone asked, "Who the hell was that?" "His name is Coke Winter," I said. "That was Coke Winter?" the man said. "Jeez!" And then everyone gazed reverently at the empty spot where his car had been parked. This was also the first long trip, the first of many, that I took with Archie A.K. Best. A.K. and I had been fishing together before, but it was the first Henry's Fork expedition that sealed us as partners. A road trip can do that by getting all the cards on the table. It also can accomplish the opposite. The usual hardships of getting out early, getting in late, getting lost, getting rained on, getting skunked, and all the other things you can get tend to reveal character in a matter of days. Creeps and idiots cannot conceal themselves for long on a fishing trip. A.K. and I have been all over hell together since then. Mostly just the two of us, based on our shared perception that two fishermen are a partnership, while any more than that constitutes a committee. We now set up our camps with such wordless efficiency that spectators sometimes think we're mad at each other. I've learned a lot from him, from the nuts and bolts of fly tying and casting, both of which he's damn good at, to philosophy. It was while fishing with A.K. that I discovered you could tell the plain truth about fly fishing and still be a humorist. I've learned a lot from him, even though he's never taught me a damn thing. And although this didn't exactly start on the Henry's Fork, it was there it hit cruising speed. The first time I saw the river, my mind was boggled more than that of a normal pilgrim because of what Coke had done to us. Coke, A.K., a man named Tom Abbott and I set out from Colorado in a borrowed camper, an enormous 6-mile-to-the-gallon land yacht that in a single 2-week trip soured me on these vehicles forever. For one thing, it wouldn't go over 45 miles per hour, even across Wyoming, where most drivers change flat tires at 45. It ate gas as if it was still in the 1950s. It was supposed to sleep 6 comfortably, but was actually about big enough for 2 or 3 close, and I mean close, friends with their gear and a change of clothes each. The fourth man was too many, and it was never clear who the fourth man was. The thing was also furnished in late Café Gothic, so that even if you were parked in the middle of fabulous scenery, you felt like you were camped with a bunch of declining rock musicians in a sleazy motel on East Colfax Avenue in Denver. And there was the unbearable suspense over whether the thing would start in the morning. But the worst part was that it was slow. I've since learned that the drive to the Henry's Fork is a crisp 12 hours, with 6 driving shifts between 2 people, and as many piss, gas, and coffee stops. A breeze in a real road car or a serviceable pickup. Now, I'm not the speed freak I once was. Not like when Ed Engel and I would get off work at our landscaping jobs, hop in his car, blast from Boulder, Colorado to Laramie, Wyoming, find a truck stop, order coffee, ask the waitress what state we were in and what the date was, and be back in time for work the next morning. But I do like to get where I'm going, and so does A.K. In fact, A.K. gets downright kittenish about it sometimes. He's even been known to drag race occasionally when one of those rural hot rodders in the 15-foot-tall pickups with the balloon tires, chrome stacks, and pinstriping revs his engine at us at a stoplight. AK's pickup is rather hot, and he's been known to win, much to the dismay of several teenagers across the western United States. You can never tell about those old guys in fishing hats. So there we were, cooped up in this lumbering dinosaur, creeping across Wyoming, being passed by one little old lady in a Volkswagen after another. After about 18 hours of that, you start to get a little testy. Coke let that work on us all by itself until we came down off the pass into Idaho on the long-awaited last leg. Then he started. There were places where we had to stop and look at the scenery. And with Coke, you don't just look, you speculate on the place's geological history and determine which plants are edible and which are not. It can take an hour. Then there was the final gas stop in Tetonia or Driggs, known as Dregs by the locals, or one of those other little towns that are an hour or so from the final destination. Coke had to tour all the gas stations to find the cheapest price. Then he had to check the air in the tires, and the oil, and the water in the radiator, all of which were, of course, fine. Then he had to have an ice cream cone. It took him 15 minutes to pick one out, and then he started with the clerk. "Tell me, sir, is this ice cream quiescently frozen?" He had to stop to look at a single trumpeter swan in a puddle by the side of the highway, which I'd have been happy to do at any other time, except that by then we were 12 miles from the Henry's Fork, for Christ's sake. Give me a break, Coke. When we finally arrived at the river, 3 of us exploded from the camper, hit the water running with fly rods still unstrung and wader suspenders unfastened, and proceeded to fall in, not catch fish, and otherwise make fools of ourselves, while Coke sat quietly on the back step of the camper and calmly took 45 minutes to tie up the perfect leader, smiling to himself all the time. The bastard. In season since, I have come to learn that Coke's sense of humor is among the most dangerous in existence, because it's practiced for his own amusement alone. It doesn't matter if you get it or not. In fact, it's probably better if you don't. And the funniest thing imaginable to him is to shake your composure while retaining his. All that notwithstanding, there it was, the fabled Henry's Fork, and in the last week in June, too, at the height of the green Drake mayfly hatch. In all of human experience, there are only 4 metaphysical summits: Valhalla, Heaven, Nirvana, and the green Drake hatch on the Henry's Fork. The Henry's Fork is known as the river where insect hatches come off not only heavily but regularly, like clockwork. That's probably close to true, but it would be more accurate to say they come off more like clockwork there than on most other streams. There are glitches even in paradise. For instance, there was a season in recent memory when the green drakes didn't come off at all, for reasons that may never be reliably determined. It just didn't happen. Another year, the hatch came off just fine, but a million seagulls arrived and ate most of them. They didn't eat all of them, of course, but even though there were still some bugs on the water, the swooping, diving gulls spooked the trout and the fishing was lousy. I missed that year, but I understand several thousand fly fishers were seriously bummed out. Relative to that season, I once heard the following conversation in the A bar on the banks of the Fork at Last Chance, Idaho. First fisherman, obviously inebriated and a bit sentimental. You remember the year the seagulls mucked up the hatch? Second fisherman. Yeah. First fisherman, after a long pause. You know, life is like that. Second fisherman. Like fishing? First fisherman. No, like seagulls. The point is, if it happened on the Henry's Fork, it was profound. The Henry's Fork is the favorite trout stream of so many fly fishers because it's exactly what you'd dream up for yourself if you could invent the perfect place using only thin air and the loftiest elements of the fly fishing tradition. It's big and sprawling. Some say it's the largest legitimate spring creek in the world, and it's not fast and brawling like many western rivers. It is, in fact, a sedate, quiet river, at least below Box Canyon. In most places, the wading is between easy and effortless, and it's been described as like a flooded parking lot. I'll buy that if you take that parking lot and scatter a few tripping-sized boulders and some surprise holes around in it. There are a few places where the wading fisherman can't go, but there are damned few he can't at least reach. And that's a good thing, because the trout are everywhere. Sure, some spots are better than others, but most of the river bottom is matted with thick vegetation, which is, in turn, grazed upon by a staggering number of aquatic nymphs that periodically emerge to become some of the most famous hatches in the literature of the sport. They're the real glamour bugs, the green, brown, and gray drakes, blue-winged olives, pale morning duns, calabitas speckled duns, tiny black-and-white trikes, mahogany duns, and others. There are also the spotty and mysterious flying antfalls, the bankside ants, beetles, and hoppers, and, of course, the workmanlike caddis hatches, which can be as delicately technical as any of the supposedly classier mayflies. If you catch any of these bugs at their best on the Henry's Fork, it will be the heaviest, fill in the blank, hatch I've ever seen. And you will babble on about it for weeks afterwards to anyone who will listen. The trout, mostly rainbows, are large, fat, healthy, and hard-fighting, and they continue to feed on insects even when they've grown well past the 20-inch mark. That, one assumes, is because there are so many bugs and so many slow currents where the fish don't have to work their little tails off to get at them. As if the river wasn't pretty enough, it meanders through sweepingly beautiful Idaho country that is stalked by everything from sandhill cranes, stop walking, then look, to moose. Given the power, this is what you'd create for yourself, but because you're not dumb or lazy, you'd also include a few whitefish, so you'd have to learn to tell the difference between their rises and those of the trout. You'd make the rainbows maddeningly picky about fly patterns and presentation to keep things interesting. And you'd include a mechanism by which the hatches were predictably regular, but still moody, so that even working from the hatch chart in the back of Mike Lawson's catalog, it would still be possible to miss them. It would be perfect, if you agree that perfection must include the dramatic element of chance, or put another way, the possibility of failure. It probably wouldn't include the crowds, however. In my own fantasy, the river is owned by me, the way Averill Harriman once owned the railroad ranch stretch, except that my guests wouldn't be magnates and diplomats. They'd be a ratty congregation of fly fishers who would stay for months, camp next to their pickups at discreet distances from one another, now and then
Sample complete. Ready to continue?